If you like playing in the field of possibilities and getting your information from those who really know, Conversation at the Cutting Edge is your kind of program. Host Sandy Sedgebeer speaks with teachers, speakers, scientists, and authors that are shifting perceptions about who we are and what we're capable of. Get ready to expand your awareness and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. Here's Sandy.
And science. A science writer and author, Travis's groundbreaking book, Tripping Over the Truth, The Metabolic Theory of Cancer, boldly challenges our current understanding and treatment of cancer and offers exciting hope of eradicating it. Travis Christofferson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy.
My hat off to you, Travis. I mean, you really have pulled off something wonderful here with this book, because science, you know, technology, medicine, drugs, it can all be so technical, but you've made this into an absolutely riveting read. So tell me, what sparked your interest in writing this book?
You know, it was kind of a convergence of, I guess, multiple factors. I was in grad school, and I was doing a project on cancer theory. And I stumbled onto this wonderful book called Cancer is a Metabolic Disease by Tom Seyfried at Boston College. And it really just struck me between the eyes, because he presented this alternative theory of cancer called the metabolic theory of cancer. And, you know, I had been taught that cancer is exclusively genetic, so I was just dumbfounded by, you know, this beautifully elegant proposed alternative theory. And I was so taken aback by it that I just sort of, dove into it head first, dove into the data, went out, interviewed Tom. And at the same time, The Emperor of Maladies, it's a book, Pulitzer Prize winning book, came out 2012 by Siddharth Mukherjee. And it's this elegant, you know, biography of cancer that sort of explains it from a genetic angle. And I really wanted to recapitulate Tom's book sort of in that format, tell the story from a historical perspective, because it's a beautiful, fantastic story that spans 100 years of cancer research and kind of lends itself well to telling it in a novel type format.
Well, tell us briefly, when was the metabolic theory of cancer first mooted, and what happened to that theory?
Yeah, so very interesting. The metabolic theory was first proposed in 1924, and it was proposed by this brilliant biochemist named Otto Warburg, who was very eccentric, you know, very arrogant, but just brilliant, unmistakably brilliant. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize three times for three separate achievements. He won the Nobel Prize once and was regarded as the world's foremost biochemist of the day. And this was a time when these guys were really, you know, put on pedestals. They were treated so well. Otto Warburg never had to ask for grant money. He was just given whatever resources he needed. And he really wanted cancer to be his sort of, what he put his name on. So when he turned his full attention to cancer, he noticed this striking metabolic abnormality right away, that cancer cells were overproducing lactic acid in the presence of oxygen. Now, that's called anaerobic energy generation. And normal cells will typically make energy aerobically with oxygen. So the question he asked was, why are they doing this? And he noticed it across the board. Almost every type of cancer was doing this. And so that was his first notice. And as his research wore on, he concluded that the prime cause of cancer was this metabolic defect, that the cause of cancer was this reversion to anaerobic energy metabolism.
So why didn't anybody listen to him?
Well, you know, initially they did in 1924 because he carried so much weight with his reputation that initially it was, you know, a very highly regarded theory. And it took some time for scientists to accumulate enough data that sort of shifted their attention to genes, to the genetic component in cancer. And it took really till about 1976 before what's called the somatic mutation theory of cancer, that contends that cancer is driven by mutations to genes, to DNA, for it really to be locked down. So Warburg's theory was always present. And I'd say in the early 70s is when the scientists really turned against it and said it's this overly simplistic view of cancer and kind of disregarded it. But that's why it was such an interesting story, because now we've been able to sequence the genome of entire cancer cells and a new picture has emerged. There's some profound gaps in the genetic theory, and Warburg's theory has kind of made this, you know, this remarkable comeback.
So how many scientists are now beginning to embrace this new theory?
It's a slow-moving process, but it's more and more. You know, since I started writing the book in about 2012, I've seen a lot more scientists become converted to the theory, and I've seen the big players in the genetics of cancer sort of change their mindset. They haven't said it outright, but there is definitely a reshuffling of viewpoints to a large degree.
You refer in the book to James Watson a lot, and obviously the man has a stellar reputation, you know, DNA, etc. And for a long time, he was very outspoken against this. I mean, he was adamant that it was genetic.
Yeah.
And he doesn't always come out looking very good in the book, because it looks as though, you know, he's kind of stealing somebody else's work and then changing his story to fit that.
Right.
But you now seem to admire him.
You know, Dr. Watson is a very... I tried to interview him for the book and I was never able to, so I really went off his writings and, you know, interviewing people that had dealt with him. Very controversial guy, and there's no mistake about that. He's had a lot of turmoil in his career for things he's said and done. So, I think he kind of leaves a wake of, and sometimes where people are upset. But there's no, you know, he was a great threat in the book because he discovered DNA, won the Nobel Prize, and turned all of his attention to cancer and helped, you know, ferret out the genetics of cancer. But then he has made this shift that, you know, recently that he's saying that we need to shift to the metabolism of cancer in return. He's even said it outright, return to the days of when the great biochemist reigned supreme like Otto Warburg. So he's made this abrupt kind of 180-degree turn. And so it was a good thread in the book to follow. Despite his controversial nature, it's kind of striking what he said.
Well, like any good thriller, you know, it seems to have its baddies and its goodies, and, you know, people racing against time to be the first to the winning post with something.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, I mean, apart from the fact that the information is just, riveting, you write it in a beautiful way, really. I mean, it is just so engaging that I can't put it down, and I don't often say that about a book. Kudos to you. You're listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with science writer Travis Christofferson about his riveting book, Tripping Over the Truth, which challenges everything we thought we knew about cancer. After the break, Travis will share where cancer therapy is going today and what's emerging as far as diet and drugs are concerned. We'll be back in a few moments. Don't go away.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
You cannot separate who you are and what you do from how you interact with the world. Marketing was never meant to be slick and soulless. If you're looking to build your personal or business profile and platform and connect with the audience that resonates with you and your message, visit www.sandysedgebeer.com and discover what 30-plus years of applying the science of resonance in international publishing, marketing, and conscious business development can do.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.
You're listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with science writer Travis Christofferson about his book, Tripping Over the Truth, The Metabolic Theory of Cancer, which boldly challenges our current understanding and treatment of the disease. Travis, we were talking about Watson before the break, and you said that, you know, he's gone on record now and he's finally changed his tune. And agreeing that there's a metabolic cause rather than a genetic cause. Now, you yourself say the timing of that announcement and switch is rather suspicious because he did some things that weren't entirely in integrity with the work of the Korean biochemist Young Ko. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, and again, this is all from my interview with Dr. Ko and Dr. Peterson. And like I said, I was never able to interview Dr. Watson. So the controversy with Dr. Watson with Dr. Ko, Dr. Ko developed a remarkable drug in her lab. And she worked in Dr. Peterson's lab. And Dr. Peterson was kind of the, he picked up where Warburg left off. He was focusing on the metabolism of cancer pretty much alone during the late 70s and 80s. But when you look back, his lab did this remarkable work, unprecedented work. And so that work led Dr. Ko to come up with this drug that attacks this metabolic defect of the cancer cell. It's called 3-bromopyruvate. And it's got this very elegant mechanism because cancer cells overproduce lactic acid. They have to make more pores to allow lactic acid to escape. These are called monocarboxylic acid or transport proteins. And so what it does is selectively let these doors open in a cancer cell. And 3-bromopyruvate is able to enter through these doors and then kill the cancer cell. So it's a very simple mechanism, but it's very elegant in its selectivity, its targeted nature. And once you develop this drug, this sort of tragic infighting began. And Dr. Watson was approached them to get funding to help them develop this drug. And Young, you know, became very suspicious of intentions and so forth and had this kind of falling out. And then it didn't go anywhere from there. But it's finally getting to this place now where we think it's going to be developed.
Well, I mean, chemotherapy, radiation, they've been, you know, the treatments of choice for so long now. And there are more and more people talking about the fact that chemo only works in, you know, about 3% of cases, and we shouldn't be giving it to people because it's the chemo that kills them in the end. So how are the drugs companies reacting to this bombshell?
About 3-bromopyruvate? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So surprisingly, this is, you know, I've been immersed in this now for some time, and there is very little interest, and it's only because the way the patents are written. 3-bromopyruvate by itself is non-patentable, so you have to patent delivery routes. And they don't have any incentive to develop 3BP because if they do it, then other drug companies could just piggyback on them because you can't patent 3BP by itself. So it kind of falls into the strange loophole where drug companies are kind of disincentivized to develop it, even though it could be one of the best drugs, you know, ever. So that's kind of the nature of the pharmaceutical, you know, what I've encountered as far as the kind of lack of interest from big pharma for 3BP.
But, you know, Dr. Ko has had a lot of resistance as well. Nobody's been willing to help her, and the NIH aren't willing to put money into this. I mean, what is wrong with everyone?
I don't know, Sandy. I've been trying to piece that together, too, since we started this, because the data is just absolutely undeniable. When you look at 3BP, and what it's done preclinically, it should be, there is absolutely no question it should be developed. Okay, so it falls into this gap in big pharma where they don't have an incentive to do it. Fine, the government should step in. And this is where government is, you know, this is their role. If something is that good for humanity, then they should step up and do it. But the NCI has shown an incredible lack of interest. Recently, they have done some cell line work that showed, you know, how remarkable the drug is. So I'm surprised they haven't had more interest. But yeah, I can't put my finger on why. I haven't been in those meetings where she's presented the data to the NCI. I know others who have, and they say there's a weird kind of just strange, combative lack of interest. And you know, I can't speak for either party why that is. But there is some other interest from other groups, and she does have offers on the table from sort of private pharmaceutical interests. So, the drug is definitely going to get developed probably within the matter of a couple of years.
Does it then have to go through the FDA?
For the U.S., yes. There's other countries where it can be kind of expedited, but the U.S., yeah, it'll have to go through trials.
Well, let's be clear about this. I mean, this is working on all cancers, isn't it? It's not just, you know, one or two.
Right. So that's kind of the remarkable nature of it, is when you look at, you know, the toxic chemotherapy we have works on most cancers because it just attacks cell division, and that's why it's so toxic. And like you quoted, the 3% statistic, as an adjunctive therapy, it confers about a 3% increase in survival, which is abysmal, and to consider the side effects that you go through for that 3%. The next generation of drugs are called targeted drugs, and they will target the sort of mutational derivatives within cancer cells, and they have been very, very disappointing. And that's kind of where Watson turned his made his abrupt about face, because these targeted drugs that we've been promised would be so good have been terrible. One drug has been fantastic. It's called Gleevec. But because of the nature of these targeted drugs, Gleevec, for example, can only be prescribed for about 0.4% of all diagnoses. It only works for chronic myelogenous leukemia. So because of the nature of the targeted drugs, they're a drop in the bucket. They don't really move the needle in the war on cancer. 3BP is a targeted drug because it targets this metabolic defect. And this metabolic defect is what you see when you have a PET scan. A PET scan uses labeled glucose, and it images that glucose. So what you see is cancer cells just sucking this blood sugar out of the bloodstream into the cells. And that's what you image. And it's just a dramatic visualization of cancer's voracious appetite for sugar. And this is that defect that Warburg noticed in 1924. 3BP theoretically can target any cancer that's PET positive, which equates to 95% of all cancers. The 5% that aren't are probably not growing or growing extremely slowly. So 3BP, you know, theoretically is capable to attack any cancer and do it extremely efficiently.
Now, decades ago, Warburg said the best way to keep cancer away is to maintain the fidelity of the respiratory apparatus through exercise, respiratory vitamins, mostly B vitamins, and the avoidance of carcinogens. Way ahead of his time, very prescient. There's also the ketogenic diet that's finding a lot of favor. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so like you just mentioned, Warburg, if cancer is viewed as a metabolic disease, a disease that precipitates because of damage to mitochondria. Mitochondria are the little cellular organelles where aerobic metabolism takes place. Then the paradigm of treatment kind of shifts to restoration of mitochondria, restoration of the ability of the cell to generate energy aerobically. And there's many ways to restore mitochondria. And so Dr. Seyfried, the one who kind of revived this whole theory, you know, the low-hanging fruit is this diet called the ketogenic diet, because it does something very unique metabolically. It sort of shifts away from blood glucose as a circulating fuel to these molecules called ketone bodies. And you do this by shifting the diet to a high degree of fat, moderate protein, and virtually cutting out all carbohydrates. So you force the body to transition from blood sugar to ketone bodies, which are manufactured from fat. And the thing about ketone bodies is they have to be burned in intact mitochondria. where glucose goes through the fermentation cycle to generate lactic acid, as Warburg noticed. So ketone bodies, as you shift away from this metabolism, put tremendous energetic stress on cancer cells. And it's really, you know, we're kind of getting glimpses of how well this diet's going to work, how the utilitarian value it's going to have. And it seems to, its best attributes seem to be the way it kind of prepares the body. It definitely can slow growth of cancer cells. We don't know if it does it to all cancers or what degree. There are clinical trials right now, so we should have answers by April. But the way it kind of prepares the cell, because it makes normal cells very robust and able to withstand other treatments. At the same time, it makes cancer cells kind of more vulnerable to other treatments like radiation and even traditional chemotherapy.
So if people can't just put themselves on a ketogenic diet, can they? It can be quite dangerous, can't it?
It can, and the people doing it urge you to work with a dietitian. You know, a lot of people will do it. There's kind of a subsect of people out there that live in ketosis. It's called nutritional ketosis, and it's sort of a dietary movement. You know, they truly believe it's the optimal state of being, that people were designed to live in this state of ketosis as opposed to the typical Western diet that's inundated with carbohydrates. So it can be done very, very safely, and it's not, you know, when you look at metabolic markers of people that do this nutritional ketosis, they're great. They usually improve from their traditional diet. So it's not something that's scary on its own. People confuse it with diabetic ketoacidosis, which would only happen if you had, you know, a diet, if you were a diabetic. But if you do have cancer and you're having other treatments, it is, you know, far and away best to do this with a nutritionist, an experienced nutritionist.
Is there any harm in me following some of the protocol? You know, high fat, low carb. You know, what's wrong with that?
Oh, you mean just a normal person without cancer?
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing wrong with it at all. And people do it, and there's a sort of an induction phase, Sandy, where if you do it, you won't feel good for about a week because your body has to transition to this new metabolism. You have to generate enzymes to burn ketones. And so there's kind of this induction phase. Most people can't get over that hump because it's kind of difficult. You just don't feel very good. But once you do, you almost feel euphoric. Once ketones really start churning through your system, your brain feels differently. Your brain operates differently on ketones. Your cerebral blood flow increases. The thermodynamic properties of these molecules are incredible. They have way more energy per unit than glucose. So your brain's operating at a higher energetic state. There's a lot of unique properties to it. It regenerates mitochondria. It stimulates mitochondrial biogenesis. There's, you know, there's a lot of biochemists that think that one of the problems with Western culture right now with our diabetes rates and so forth is that we never enter this ketogenic state where we were sort of designed to have these times of periodic starvation where you enter ketosis and you this sort of renewal period, and we just don't get that anymore.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of attention over the last 5 years on, you know, it's got different names in England. They call it the fast diet, but where you spend 2 days a week just on 500 calories. Yeah. Calorie restriction has been around for a long time as, you know, a potential anti-ager.
Yeah.
So in your book, you actually give people some tips of the kinds of things, you know, to eat and those to avoid. You know, the book is so full of fantastic information. It's hard for me to know where to begin. As I said at the beginning of the show, it's not often I'm this excited. Before we bring the show to a close, what do you most want our listeners to know?
You know, I think the take-home message of the book is hopefulness. And what struck me about cancer research and the Emperor of All Maladies, which, like I said, is sold better, I think, than any cancer book, has kind of become this tomb. But it ended with this terrible sort of cast cancer as this inevitability. Like it's a product of random mutations that are going to occur. You can't do anything about it. Cancer stitched into our genomes. We may never be able to separate it out. The metabolic theory completely is different from that. It doesn't cast it as this disease of inevitability. It casts us as this disease that is fixable, is something we can prevent and through these different avenues, but we just haven't looked at it from this new angle, so it's gonna take time. But I think the take-home message is, you know, it's a very hopeful time in cancer biology, and I think we're going to really make big strides within the next 10 years.
Well, finally, Travis, where can people get the book?
Amazon is the best place to get it.
So it's on Kindle and in paperback?
Yep, that's correct. And I just got word from a German publisher. They're going to translate it in German and sell it in all the major bookstores in Germany now, too.
Perfect. And if people want to find out more about you, your website?
I have a website dedicated to helping these therapies called Single Cause, Single Cure, and it's a foundation website, and you can donate. And what I try to do is I've kept it very simple, and I've funding projects that can help a huge amount of people. We're doing one right now with oxaloacetate in a ketogenic diet, and we do have results, and they should be published very soon. So that's exciting, and I'm starting another website called Metabolic Optimization. It'll be a blog and a podcast where we hope to disseminate more of this information.
Travis Christofferson, thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sandy.
Wow. Go out and buy the book. It really is a page turner. That brings us to the end of this show. For advanced news of future guests, sign up for my newsletter at sedgbeer.com. The theme tune for the show is from an original song called Searching by Grammy Award-winning producer, composer and musician Barry Goldstein. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to having your company at the same time next week. And don't forget, until then, you can listen to more great shows live and in our archive here at vividlife.me.
Thank you for listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge, where scientists, researchers, authors, and teachers working at the leading edge meet. For conversations that aim to shift your perceptions about who you are, why you're here, and what you can achieve when you open your mind, expand your awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. Join us next week, same time, with your host, Sandy Sedgbeer, for another Conversation at the Cutting Edge.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
You cannot separate who you are and what you do from how you interact with the world. Marketing was never meant to be slick and soulless. If you're looking to build your personal or business profile and platform and connect with the audience that resonates with you and your message, visit www.sandysedgbeer.com and discover what 30-plus years of applying the science of resonance in international publishing, marketing, and conscious business development can do.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.